irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood. I'm Nikki Corulla with my co-host with the most, Ronan Rosner. How are you, buddy?
I'm good. How are you?
2 weeks in a row, you're going to end up kicking Eddie out of his gig. How was your week?
It was fine. You know, nice. We went to this motorcycle show in Long Beach over the weekend.
Like a show or like a race?
No, not a race. A show. You know, all the different manufacturers and accessories.
Like a motocross and stuff like that?
Every kind of motorcycle you can think of. You know, the custom shops.
Oh, that's dope.
Oh, yeah.
So you probably saw like custom Harleys, custom race
of
bikes?
Of course. Everything you can think of.
Yeah. You have a bike too, right?
I used to. Not right now. That's the reason why we went
I want to go back.
I do.
Did you ever race motorcycles?
Uh-huh. Actually, I did.
That's crazy.
Amateur circuit. I even went to my highlight of my short amateur career was racing in Donington in Britain, one of the most famous racetracks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I won't say my finish position
was. What's the fastest speed you ever reached?
Oh,
talk about that.
270, a little over 270.
Seriously?
Kilometers. So it's about 180 miles per hour.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm. And you don't feel like you're going to be out of control at that speed?
No. Because, you know, these bikes, they're all built for speed. And
right. And
so you kind of tuck in, lower your head, and just go open the throttle.
That's
just
crazy.
Go straight. It was fun.
You don't take turns at that. Obviously, you can't.
What do you mean, turns?
Like you know, those wide turns.
Oh, yeah.
You take them at 180?
Of course. Well, not wide. Well, I wasn't. But, yeah, I mean, professional racers, yeah, they take them in over 100 easily.
Is crazy.
Yeah, they got, you know, super grippy tires, race tires, the tarmac, the what they use to surface those racetracks is, you know, super kind of grippy, so yeah, you don't slip.
Did it give you the urge to get back on a bike?
It does.
Like,
although
yes.
My sports bikes days are over. I'm not into that anymore, but I just kind of like, you know, having some kind of a touring. I'm not into custom Harleys now. But I'll
Why
give
not?
I don't know. I never liked those.
Because they're too bulky?
They are. Okay. They are. Yeah. If I ride a bike, I want something, you know, light and nimble.
Yeah.
Take those corners, those twisty roads.
My dad used to have a Triumph.
Oh.
He loved those bikes. And so he rode a motorcycle for a while until he had kids.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had to give them up. But like lately, he's like, you know, it'd be good to get back on a motorcycle. I'm like, Pops. You know, they're a lot faster than they were back in the day.
Yeah.
Maybe it's time to hang it up, you know. But did it make you want to get, you were like, I want a bike.
Yeah, yeah. And I was amazed by the variety of electrical bikes.
Really?
There's even one. Yeah, oh yeah. Anything from those, you know, small mopeds all the way, this one manufacturer of sports bikes, Italian. So you look, the bike, it just looks amazing because they know how to design.
Yeah, the Italians with the race cars.
Exactly.
I mean, they're,
so the whole,
they're born to do that stuff.
Yeah, so the whole motorcycle is just like a regular motorcycle, including the chain, but the motor is electrical.
Hmm.
And that thing can,
What's the fastest? What's like a top
speed? I think its top speed is over 100 miles per hour.
That's pretty decent.
Yeah.
And how you probably don't have to charge it that long. It's not like a car.
No. Well, yeah, it doesn't. Usually, they said, I think, about 70 miles between charge. So, yeah, that's the biggest problem with electrical vehicles right now, most of them at least.
And the drivers.
Yeah.
Because I was just buying a Prius driver, man. It's crazy. I don't know. Sometimes Prius drivers, they don't always drive the best.
Yeah.
Drives me a little crazy sometimes.
Them and Subaru drivers. Yes. And I own a Subaru. But it's, most of them, they drive those Outbacks, and they're like, relax. And like, come on.
Yeah, come on. It's LA traffic. Let's do this. Were you getting ready for Thanksgiving?
Oh, I am. I am. I got doing, my shopping
you're
list.
You're doing vegetarian, right?
Yes, I am. Although, you know, we're being guests at someone's house. So I told them, don't go, you know, crazy about making vegetarian dishes for me. Prepare whatever you want, including the turkey. I'll eat, you know, whatever.
What are you going to bring? Are you going to bring something?
I think we're scheduled for, I mean, we were supposed to bring the desserts, as far as I know. My wife makes this killer Nutella and whipped cream.
Ooh.
Chocolate mousse.
Damn.
Oh, yeah.
That sounds awesome.
It is.
You have to share that recipe, man.
I will. It's so easy.
I may have to cut off one of your wrists for it. But you don't need two wrists anyways, right? One's good.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah, my mom's making, she makes this crazy kombucha squash pie, which is going to replace pumpkin pie this year. But it's
nice.
It's good, man. It's good. My mom's a good cook. And my girlfriend's a good cook. So put them together, and it's like fat kid heaven. Chubby man heaven, for sure. Anyways, our guest, special guest has arrived. We have a very special guest indeed. Native Wayne Jobson. Give him a hand. Wayne, you don't know this, or maybe you do, but I've been a fan of you for a long time. I used to listen to Wayne do the Sunday reggae nights on K-Rock. You did that for a long time.
Way back, yeah, man, 7 years.
That's right. You know, and I listened to that religiously because it was a way for me to get introduced to so much reggae that wasn't, you know, mainstream, wasn't the biggest names. So you introduced me to Toots and the Maytals, and you introduced me to Burning Spear. You played a lot of stuff that, you know, at the time wasn't super on the charts or anything, so... I owe a lot of that love of reggae to you. So
maximum respect, man. Yeah, I was so lucky because at the time, K-Rock was the number one station in America and the number one modern rock station in the world. And I got a chance to break bands. So not only was I playing the Marleys and the Burning Spears and the Third Worlds, but I was the first one to play Sublime, which is one of the greatest bands of all time. Brad Noel and Brad, I got to meet Brad a few times. Very genius songwriter.
That's crazy. He's one of my favorites as well.
So great. I was the first one to play No Doubt, 311, all those bands. I kind of helped break them. So I was breaking the rock reggae as well as playing the roots reggae.
And that's some of my favorite stuff. All those bands you just mentioned. No Doubt, 311. 311 is one of my favorite bands as well.
And I'm so lucky because after that, now then I got to work with them. So, you know, I took No Doubt to Jamaica and I won 2 Grammys with them. We did with Underneath It All and Hey Baby. And also I sang on rapped on a few of the 311 records. And Sugar Ray did one of my songs, which we're going to play today.
Yeah, yeah.
And, so I got to work with a lot of those guys. And then I worked with the Long Beach Double Stars after Brad died.
Yeah.
Which was Sublime without Brad. And it'd never be the same. You know, even the new Sublime, you know, it's good. And Rome is, you know, doing a good job, but nobody can match Brad.
You know, the funny thing is Rome is a talented dude. My band opened up for Sublime with Rome, and it wasn't the same. We were kind of disappointed. It was like one of those things where we were all diehard Sublime fans. We've covered Sublime songs, and I just love that band, but it's just not the same chemistry. It's just a different thing.
And only really Eric from the band is here, because Bud left, you know, and so just really one member of Sublime. And you know, it's still, I mean, I'm glad, because the good thing about it is that it's keeping the music going. It's kind of like the Wailers without Bob, you know, they're keeping the music going, and they keep people go back and buy the catalog and all that. And of course, Brad's kid gets to go to college and all this sort of thing. And he has a band of his own now called Law.
Oh, that's Brad's cool, really?
Yeah.
Is it influenced by Sublime?
Yeah. It's a hard rock kind of stuff, a lot of punk in it and all that. They played a DJ at a reggae festival in Las Vegas a few weeks ago, and he played, and it was really good. And the Long Beach Double Stars also played, so it was a mixture of having, you know, Brad's son and then the actual
band.
That's
awesome.
That was really cool.
Let's go way back, Wayne, because I'm so curious about this. One of the best things I love about doing the show is, even though I've known you for a while, I learn more about people, even like people I've known for 20 years, in this hour than I get to know them in 20 years of even just being friends. So I want to know, like, what got you into music? I know you grew up in Jamaica. Tell us a little bit about that. You have some really well-known friends. Let's talk about some of that as well. But what got you into music? What fed the need for you to want to be involved?
I mean, I guess like a lot of musicians nowadays and around my kind of era is, of course, the thing that changed their life was seeing the Beatles and Ed Sullivan. You know, that was just like everything became technicolor after that. Before that, it was black and white. And so, of course, my biggest influence through the years has been, you know, the Beatles and Bob Marley, Bob Dylan. Those three are my biggest influences. And
those are three good ones.
Right. And so, and also lucky on top of that was that my cousin, a guy called Dickie Jobson, he passed now, but he started Island Records with Chris Blackwell.
Wow.
And he used to manage Bob Marley and the Wailers, and his sister Diane was Bob Marley's lawyer. So growing up as a kid, I got to go to the studio with Bob Marley and then with Peter Tosh and just see the greats, you know, see the greatest songwriter of all time, Bob Marley writing his songs, and got
That's
to actually
so
jam
crazy.
With him and stuff like that. So it was just very special that I could be around that. You know, at the same time, Jamaica was a very musical center point, a kind of a vortex, because Paul McCartney used to come down a lot, so I used to get to see him, and Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones lived down there. So basically, we had the two biggest bands in the world kind of hanging out in Jamaica, and also when we had Bob Marley there. So the influence of all of those just kind of inspired
me. You think that was because reggae was becoming such a force in music? Like right around like mid-70s, early 70s, that's when it was really rising.
Really rising, and the songwriting at that time was amazing, and that was when, you know, we'd Catch a Fire, Bob Marley, and Peter Tosh's Legalize It and all those albums, Bonnie Wailer's Black Heart Man. It was just so much genius songs being written in reggae. And that's what's happened to reggae right now, is that the songwriting has gone to hell. It's like the standard is so low, you can't find any good songs. And I tell people, you know, when I'm doing my radio show and I get paid, I said, I don't get paid to play those 20 good songs that you heard. I get paid for listening to 1,000 horrific songs to find those 20 good songs. You know,
but nobody values that anymore. No. It just drives me crazy.
Yeah,
and a lot of bands, I feel like funk bands and reggae bands can hide behind a reggae groove or a funk groove very easily. They can have a terrible song and then hide behind a really great groove that just grooves no matter what. And the song won't really kind of have legs, but because the groove is so likable that you can hide, you can kind of mask behind these great grooves. So
exactly, and people are like dancing, so they're not really listening to the melody and the lyrics. And sometimes when you listen to a lot of the modern reggae, you listen to there's no melody, and you listen to there's no decent lyrics. It's just kind of like a lot of rap, just gangster and, you know, and drugs and guns and women and, you know, sex and stuff like that, and nothing really, no consciousness. So the consciousness is really gone. You know, when you saw the great consciousness that we got from Peter Tosh, who was, you know, of course, was my favorite. I mean, I've tell people, I've been lucky in my life to, you know, to know the kind of Mick Jaggers and Paul McCartneys and Bonos and all that. And the greatest rock star I ever met in my life was Peter Tosh. You know, he just was this genius musician and just so brilliant politically and very, very funny and amazing image and just a very, very powerful politically. He was kind of like the Jamaican Malcolm X.
Wow.
And so I did a documentary about his life, which was called, it's called Red X. You can actually watch it on YouTube if you're bored. And it's
not bored. I'm going to go home and watch that, man.
It's called Peter Tosh Red, the letter X. And he got nominated for an Academy Award in Canada. And it's his whole life story as told by him, because after he passed, I'd known him and his wife, and I went to the house, and she gave me some tapes. And she said, well, you won't be interested in these tapes because it's just Peter talking. But when I listened to it, it was like finding the Dead Sea Scrolls, because Peter had sat down and taped his whole life onto a tape recorder, intending to use that to write a book. You know, you tape it first and then you write a book. But he got murdered, and so he couldn't write the book. So I made the film with him narrating the whole film and recreated the images of what he said.
He
so
got murdered by somebody that he let into his house, right?
Yes, it was so crazy. I mean, he knew this guy, and he was just trying to help the guy. You know, as a very had a guy with a big heart, and the guy just came and one time and just demanded money and just killed him. That's crazy. So sad. Yeah, man.
It's amazing that you were around two of the biggest reggae greats, Peter Tosh and Bob. I mean, that time too. It's just like, I can imagine Paul McCartney and Keith Richards just wanting to feed off that energy, but you were right there in the middle of it.
And that's why, and even, you know, even Mick Jagger, who was, you know, he was kind of a rebel. He used to be a rebel, and he, in Peter Tosh, he saw the real rebel. So that's why he actually signed Peter Tosh to Rolling Stone Records, and they have that song Walk and Don't Look Back together. And he produced, him or Keith produced Peter Tosh's records, because he saw the real rebel that he wished he could be, you know what I mean? And that's why they did suffer. That's why they would come to Jamaica a lot, because they saw that authentic kind of revolutionary spirit in Tosh and Marley and all that. They wanted to capture a bit of that lightning in a bottle.
Well, he was like a visionary, without a doubt. Definitely. And were you playing music all this time? Like,
yeah, as a kid playing, you know, high school bands and all that sort of things. And then I was lucky enough to, just before, I went and studied law in England because I'm a lawyer as well. And when I was just about to leave for England, and I met Lee Scratch Perry, and I so recorded my first demo with him. Went to England and got a deal with Arista Records, which was Clive Davis. So I was the first reggae artist signed to Arista Records, and the band was called Native. And so
that's amazing. Really lucky. I didn't even know that about you.
Oh yeah, and but lucky to work with the great Lee Scratch Perry, because that's, you know, the greatest Jamaican producer ever. And of course, not only did Marley and all the great reggae stuff, but he also produced The Clash and Paul McCartney and Robert Palmer and so many great people. And when I went in the studio with him at the Black Ark, the famous studio in Jamaica, he had just finished doing Paul McCartney and he was doing Robert Palmer. So I was in good company as a little kid, just trying to make it in
music.
That's
incredible.
So, I was very lucky that he saw something in me and produced a record. And so that's how I got my record deal. So I kind of owe it all to Scratch, you know, like starting from scratch.
And he's like a mad scientist in there, too. Yeah. He's just brilliant.
Completely mad, you know, because you have to understand, we're some young kids and we can't play that good, you know. We're just like almost like a high school band. And he saw something. I think he saw the songs because the songs were strong. And so he did it, and he made us sound amazing. And the album, we just re-released the album, just came out on Cleopatra Records. It's the 40th anniversary of the album. It's called Lee Scratch Perry Presents Native at the Black Ark. And it's available, it's in stores, and it's on iTunes and all that sort of stuff. And you can hear the magic that he created from these kids who were okay musicians, but a genius producer. You can make something good happen.
Well, what's cool, too, is like music, as you listen to it 20 years later, 30 years, 40 years, it changes. So it's got like a different life. Do you hear it now, and does it take you back to that time, or do you hear it as a almost like a nostalgic thing that you couldn't maybe hear when you were making it? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. When you're actually making it, you don't realize, you never realize if it's any good or not. You know what I mean? You're just trying. You wrote the song, and you're hoping that people will like it. And the reviews were amazing, and everybody loved it. And when I went to England, all these record companies were just like, hey, you know, we heard about you. And I was actually, another thing I was really lucky to do was when I first got to London to study law, and I met Johnny Rotten from the Sex Pistols, and he was like the biggest star in England at the time, and he loved it, and he went and told the press and everybody and the record companies that the next big thing was going to be Wayne Jobson. So all the record companies called me up and go, hey, Rotten told us that you have the best reggae music and that you're going to be a big star. I could never tell them that I'm a law student, you know.
Right.
I said, yeah, you know, I have the biggest band in Jamaica and we've been together for 10 years. And they're like, how much money do you want? So I got the money and then set up the whole band, you know, and did it. So it was, you know, they say you have to kind of fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
You know? So you just have to kind of bluff. And the music was strong enough. And because Lee Scratch Perry had produced it, they were not only signing me, but they were really signing Lee Scratch Perry. You know what I mean? His production.
Yeah. So did he produce all the records that you did?
Well, no. So we did that record, which just came out, Lee Scratch Perry Presents Native at the Black Ark. And then by the time I got back to Jamaica, got the money from Arista, went back to do the proper album with him, he had gone crazy and he burnt down the studio.
Yeah, I remember that. He actually lit it.
Lit it
right?
up, yeah. And burnt up all the Bob Marley tapes. And I mean, the whole thing, it was one of the last things recorded at that studio, and that's why it sounds so amazing, because that studio had a sound about it. He only had 4 tracks, you know, you understand? And by that time, we have to remember 24 tracks had been invented. So for Paul McCartney to come to Jamaica and leave his Abbey Road studio and come to Jamaica to record on 4 tracks with Lee Scratch Perry, he wasn't coming for the studio, he was coming for the genius behind the board. You know, that was Scratch. And so Scratch made McCartney sound great, and of course made Robert Palmer sound great, and made Native sound really good, because we were not as good as he made us sound.
Did he ever tell you why he just burned the studio?
No, I think he
just bad juju or something?
Yeah, he had smoked. Yeah, he stopped smoking after about 50 years of smoking. Herb, he stopped smoking, and he said it was like seeing God. He got that clarity. But that time he was smoking so much that I think he just kind of lose it. And, you know, I hate to say, but everybody kind of glamorizes, you know, ganja, weed smoking, and you know, and Bob Marley kind of made it hip and all that. But if I get a chance here to say it, I don't think that it's good for people to smoke 24/7. You know, and of course the Rastas think that it's a sacrament, yeah, and it is. And if they want to do that, that's fine. I can't tell anybody what to do. But for kids coming up, especially in January, it's going to be recreational in California. I do not suggest any kids under 18 should be smoking. You know, and if you're going to smoke, for people who I know who smoke, who are hugely successful, in the night, you know, they finish work and they go home and they cool out and they might drink a beer or they might drink a glass of wine or they might just have 2 or 3 puffs off of a spliff. But they're not going to just wake up in the morning and just smoke 24/7.
Right.
I don't know how these guys do it. And they lose their goddamn minds. Your brain cannot function in that. It's the equivalent of just waking up and drinking 5 bottles of scotch. You know, your body can't deal with it.
Your brain can't deal with it.
So I just hope that even though we're going to have recreational, that there'll be some kind of control, that the kids won't be just smoking it 24/7 at school and all that. It's insane.
Well, I always, like, it's like, when I used to smoke, it's like, if you're able to just get work done, you know, and then you kind of use it as relaxation.
Relaxation.
That's one thing. But a lot of kids, they're doing it right when they wake up, and you kind of like shoot yourself in the, you know, in the foot for the rest of the day because you're not functioning, right, you know, at 100%. So
and motivation, it lacks motivation, it kills motivation, you know. And so I see a lot of lazy people because of that. I just wish that people would use it as a medicine, because remember, it's a medicine. Like, if you get a headache, you take two aspirin,
right?
You don't take aspirin all day. You only take it when you need it. So, like, night time comes or sometime during the day, you need a little inspiration, you want to read a book or watch a movie, write a song. So you take one or two puffs. You don't smoke a half an ounce or something like that. Because then you
but reggae artists loved. They'll sit there all day.
All day. That's what I don't understand, how they even function. Right. Because it's like, it's too early. So they should, people should be using it as a medicine. Just take two puffs, like two aspirins, when you need it. Because it is a medicine, but don't just do it all day. And the damage that it does is really crazy.
Well, let's get to one of your songs real quick, because I'm excited to hear these tracks. Yeah. So you want to play, which one do you want to play first?
Well, because we're just talking about Lee Scratch Perry, and this was one of the last things recorded at the Black Hawk before he burnt it down. And this is the genius of Lee Scratch Perry, together with Native, Late September and May.
All right, let's hear it.
Decisions to attend. I took my time to make my moves and counted all my sins. But times they change and values fade, no matter what they say. Now I'm alone, save for a song. And it feels like late September. September in May. It isn't really all that bad when you remember the good times. Count up all the loves you scored and laugh at all the lies. 'Cause tomorrow was a word you spoke but never read. Today is in the way, the future's always blurred. But times they change and values fade, no matter what they say. Now I'm alone, save for a song. And it feels like late September. September and May. I strolled into the cinema after I paid the price. Took a back row seat to watch the movie of my life. But empty seats were everywhere. There was no one there to quiet panic that ensued with each succeeding reel. That times have changed and values faded, and I don't care what they say. Now I'm alone, save for this song. And I'm feeling late September. Late September in May. Late September in May. Late September in May. Late September in May.
Tosh influence in like the vocal production and the melody. Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Thanks, man. Because remember, of course, Scratch produced the Wailers, which was yeah. Peter Tosh. So he.
And the bass sound is awesome. Who's playing bass?
Cool bass? It was a guy called Sabo Bennett.
Man, he was so killing. So good, yeah, man. Because like the groove was so slow, but the bass line, all these subdivisions were so. Loved it. Very cool. Very cool. What year did you record that?
77.
Man.
No, 78, I think it was. Was that it? Yeah.
And that's all done on four tracks?
Yeah, four tracks.
That's wicked.
So to get Scratch and get sound that good with four tracks was amazing, you know?
That is, I mean, now he still does some work every now and then, right?
Yeah. He's more an artist now. He tours and he goes on stage and kind of talks craziness with a dub band behind him. So it's, I mean, I'm kind of mad at him because he is one of the greatest producers of all time. He's kind of like a George Martin from the right. Beatles. And he should be in the studio producing bands. But yeah. He knows that records don't sell anymore. So
right.
He just wants to tour and have fun, go on stage and talk madness and, you know, and get paid. So
yeah.
I mean, he's maybe 70-something, nearly 80, so... You can, whatever he wants to do, you know, you have to just allow him to do it. You know?
I saw him at the Key Club maybe 8 years ago. And yeah, it was exactly what you said. It was just like this cool band, and he was just like running around, just kind of like rapping a little bit.
Craziness.
And, yeah.
one of the reasons why that thing also sounded so good was because my kind of band leader on that session was a guy called Joe Higgs, who was the godfather of reggae music.
Yeah.
He taught Bob Marley and Wailers to sing, and he gave me a few voice lessons, and he came in on that session and played percussion and just was kind of band lead. And so I had basically two of the geniuses of reggae music, Lee Scratch Perry and Joe Higgs, doing that session, and that's why it sounded so
Didn't cool. Joe teach Bob how to sing?
Yeah.
He was the first singer, singing teacher he had,
teacher,
right?
Teacher for Bob, yeah.
That's so crazy. Man, you were in all the circle with all the people that I read about nonstop about reggae music. That's insane.
I was so blessed to be in that vortex when it was just, and that's when all the greatest reggae music came out, was, you know, in the 70s there, and just got in the 80s when dancehall came, it just really went downhill.
Yeah.
It just became like rap music, just kind of like, you know, disposable sort of dance stuff, but it didn't have the depth and the structure and the kind of meaningfulness that the revolutionary spirit of the 70s.
But it still has like such an influence. Reggae music, now you can hear it in pop music. Which, you know, I never thought that I would see that. You know, it's like you came from this era of like all the 70s and 80s, kind of like early 80s stuff, which is great. But, you know, now to see it 30 years later as an influence in a style, I never thought I'd hear it in an Ariana Grande track or whatever. Right. That's wild to me, you know.
Especially with the dancehall, because when you consider the three biggest songs of the year, is the Desperitos, is that what it's called? The one with Bieber on it. And the one with Drake's One Dance.
Yep.
And also Ed Sheeran's The Body Song. So the three biggest songs of the year all have dancehall in it, you know, and dancehall and reggae feel. So obviously the people still love the music.
Let's talk about, like, you did some producing with a lot of these artists. Mm-hmm. Like, how did you make that transition from being an artist? You work with Clive and all these people and Lee Scratch Perry. How did you make that transition into being a producer?
So, well, when I was in L.A. and then K-Rock offered me the radio show. So at the radio show, that's when I got to meet, you know, No Doubt, Gwen and the whole crew, and 311 and Brad and Sublime and everybody. So they asked me to just kind of help them. So that's when I took No Doubt to Jamaica and we did the Rocksteady album, and that's when we won the Grammys with Hey Baby and Underneath It All. And then with 311, Long Beach Double Stars, just working with all of them, just helping them to get that kind of, you know, authentic sound. Reggae sound.
Yeah.
And a lot of the projects I would do, I'd bring in Sly and Robbie. Because you know, for the actual rhythm section, you know, for them to be the rhythm section in it, they kind of create a whole magic. So I still do a lot of projects with Sly and Robbie, and I'm actually going back to Jamaica in about 2 weeks, and we're doing a kind of a blues album. It's going to be called Red, Green, Gold, and Blues, and we're getting all the great blues songs and a lot of the great blues players to come down and play with Toots and the Maytals and all those guys, and create a magic combination of blues and reggae together. And I'm doing it with a guy called Zach Starkey, who is one of the best drummers in the world. He plays drums in The Who, and his father is Ringo Starr from the Beatles, and he used to be the drummer in Oasis. So Zach is definitely an absolute genius drummer and great guitarist, and he is, you know, the project is going to be really great, Red, Green, Gold, and Blues, and Sly and Robbie is going to play.
That's a great name and great ensemble, man. Toots is like one of my favorite artists. Funky Kingston changed my life, and I saw him maybe when I was in high school, I think. I've seen him a bunch of times, but the first time I saw him, I was like, man, this is as good as reggae is. Yeah. You know, it's like he is top of the charts.
First of all, Toots invented the word reggae, if you look in the Guinness Book of Records. But also in Jamaica, he's such royalty, and he's the nicest guy. He's such royalty that, I'll tell you a funny story, is that Diane Jobson, who was my cousin, who was Bob Marley's lawyer, she's Toots' lawyer, now. And so I was with her one day, and Toots, you know, Toots called and said he was going to bring some good, a good draw for her, which means a good, you know, spliff. So some, bring some good spliff for her. So she waited the whole day, and when the night came, now Toots didn't bring it. And so she called and said, Toots, where the hell is the weed that you're bringing for me? Toots said, listen, where I go and get my weed down in Trenchtown, the whole place is cordoned off. It's under military curfew. They've shut down the whole place. So I'm getting a police escort to take me down there to get the weed. So the only man in Jamaica who gets a police escort to get weed is
that
Toots.
Is awesome. That's right.
Yeah, I know
he gets
royalty,
a pass.
Pass right. Total royalty, you know.
That's crazy. Mm. So you also worked on a track with Chrissy Hine. Let's talk a little
yeah,
bit about that.
Really good. So same kind of thing. When I was at K-Rock, and I got to meet a lot of the artists, you know, and then Chrissy, she came down to Jamaica to do a show. One of the best shows I've actually seen, and they shot it down in Jamaica with Carlos Santana, Chrissy, Johnny Marr from the Smiths, Ziggy Marley, Bonnie Wailer, a lot of people. It was after Bob Marley had passed and after Peter Tosh had passed, so they weren't on it, but Ziggy was on it, and really amazing show that they put together. It was for HBO or Showtime. It was one of those kind of specials, reggae special. I think it was called a reggae session or something like that. And so I met Chrissy, and then when I was at K-Rock and I was interviewing her one day, and she said to me, you know, whenever I hear a song done in reggae, it sounds better than the original.
Mm.
So I said, well, listen to this. And I played her Here Comes the Night, a song that I had done, which was originally done by Van Morrison from them had done Here Comes the Night. So I played it for her, and she goes, oh, yeah, that's better than the original. So I said, you want to sing on it? And she's like, yeah. So she sang on it, and then I got it on the soundtrack of Ace Ventura, which was a Jim Carrey film.
But it's a great movie. It's a classic
great
movie.
Yeah, man. I was lucky to meet Jim, and he really liked it and all that. So. Which is so I guess maybe we can play that now.
Yeah, let's play it. Let's play it.
Here's Native with Chrissy Hine. Here Comes the Night.
Here comes the night.
You're right. It does sound better.
It does. And you know what? To have two iconic voices like yours and Chrissy Hynde too, like.
Well, I mean, it was very tough for me in a show because Chrissy's one of the greatest female voices out there. I mean, she's unbelievable. So trying to sing with her was really tough because.
Did you track it together?
No.
So I mean, did you do your part
and then she did. So actually, went to England and did it with her in England. You know, and I done mine in LA and then we did it in England. But I mean, her voice was just so good. It was hard for me to try and match, you know, sound anywhere half as good as her. But you know,
she's got a very distinct vocal delivery. That's what I love about her. It's like. When you hear her sing, you can hear it in a thousand voices, and you can still hear her voice.
Definitely.
You know what I mean? Yeah,
yeah. Very,
that's
very
awesome.
Very, very powerful.
That must have been exciting.
Definitely, man. Yeah.
What year did you record that? It must have been early 90s? No, mid 90s?
Yeah, I think that was about 95, 96, something like that. Yeah, about 20 years ago. Wow. Yeah,
it must have been cool to see it on the big screen. Did you go see the movie? And
Yeah, man.
See, that's got to be really such
cool.
A rush.
Yeah, man, the premiere of the movie was a lot of fun.
That's awesome, man. That's really awesome. Great. So, like, when you hear a reggae artist today, because you've been working with so many iconic people, do you get a little frustrated with like reggae artists or any new artists today? Because I find myself like, you know, I haven't even been doing it that long, but I've been doing it long enough to know when I hear a terrible song that makes it onto a radio station and it's being deemed as a hit, it just drives me nuts.
Definitely.
It drives me crazy.
Yeah. So. And the thing is, I mean, with reggae, that you have to understand that reggae has the greatest artists, because if you try to find anybody on earth to sing better than Barrington Levy, Levy is unbelievable. Barrington is going to be on this Blues Records with us too. I just went and saw him up in the hills of Jamaica. He lives way up in this place that is impossible to find, and he has his own radio station up there. So he's the first reggae artist to own his own radio station. I think it's called Roses 93, the 89.5 or something like that. And Barrington is... So, you know, you have the greatest voice. If you ever see a performance by Third World or by Luciano, it's like the best performance. Nobody can perform like those guys.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the songs, you know, they don't have the songs. Once in a while, you get a great song. Like, there's a song called Who Knows, which is Protégé and Chronix together. It's one of the best reggae songs of the past few years, you know. Or a song like She's Royal, Taurus Riley. You know, once in a while, they come in. But it's rare to find a song as good as those. You know.
Well, and I look at all the old Bob records, for example, or Toots. And everything was so song-driven. It just drives me crazy. I don't know when that stopped being a thing, because now I feel like the standards of songwriting have just become so low.
Right.
And you listen to Bob, like, you can tell he was influenced by R&B. You listen to Toots, you can tell he was influenced by other sounds to make this really kind of like jambalaya vibe of a song and then put it to a killing reggae groove. That's why it worked. That's why it's like people are still listening to those records. And he's able to still tour, you know what I mean?
And what happened was, you see, in those days, remember, Toots had his guitar writing songs. Bob had his guitar, Peter Tosh writing songs on the guitar or keyboards. Then reggae changed and it became a rhythm thing.
Mm-hmm.
So like a producer would just make a rhythm, a drum and bass and some things happening. And then all the singers would come in and sing over that rhythm, just force a song to it. And when you force a song to a rhythm, it's not really a song that came from your heart that you wrote at home one night when the lightning was flashing or something,
right,
you know?
Right.
You're just going to the studio and you have 5 minutes to just come up with an idea. So it just became a kind of a hustle. So the whole dancehall thing with the rhythms became a hustle and people stopped writing those great songs. And that's when the whole thing just went down. You know, once in a while you hear them, but for reggae to come back, we're going to need those kind of great songwriting, because we have the greatest singers, we have the greatest performers, and image-wise and everything, like Protégé, you know, it's one of the best artists out there right now. And of course, he has amazing image, you know, and look, and on stage, he's really good and everything. Just... He has a new song called Blood Money, which you can check out. Protégé's Blood Money, really, really good. But that's rare to find something as good as that, you know.
Well, it's also like you've had such a fingerprint in all these like kind of different forms of reggae, dance hall and dub and mostly, you know, organic reggae music, that it's like when you hear it now, it's like such a watered down version. There's so many, you know, there's so many bad reggae bands that I hear all the time. But I'll go to festivals and I'm like, man, this is crazy. But it's important that, you know, producers like yourself, artists like yourself, are more involved with artists today, because you bring in that heritage, you bring in that legacy, you bring in that history to kind of teach that new generation. So, you know, I want artists to know who you are all the time, because I think the world of you, and you've showed me so much reggae music, and I hope you continue to make records. You know what I mean?
Thanks, man. And a good example of it is like, you have reggae and you have dancehall, which is two different things. And so I was lucky enough that we got two number ones and two Grammys with No Doubt doing Underneath It All,
yep,
with Lady Saw, which is reggae, and then No Doubt doing Hey Baby with Bounty Killer, which is dancehall. So it's possible to do it, to have great songs in both genres and still get number one.
Yeah, one was a ballad, you know, like kind of like a power ballad, mm-hmm, and one was like an upbeat dance track.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? And it's like two different forms, but using the same styles. That's what made it so brilliant, you know?
Definitely, man.
Let's play something else. What are we going to play? Well, you choose. This time you choose, Wayne.
Let me see. Okay, so just as far as songwriting, so we talked now about production that I did and all different people I've worked with. But one of the things I was going to bring is me and my brother Brian, we did an album called The Wingless Angels with Keith Richards. But those songs are about 15 minutes long. They're really long, and it's kind of like Rasta chants, you know. So for the show, because we have limited time, I figured I wouldn't play The Wingless Angels. But as far as songwriting, I wrote this song for Sugar Ray, Mark McGrath and Sugar Ray and Rodney and them, and they recorded it on the Music for Cougars album. Yeah, so here is written by Native Wayne. Here is Sugar Ray with Love 101.
All right.
Treat her like you want to be treated. Give her everything under the sun. You're on your way to a great day in love. Love 101. Tell her that you don't want no other. Show her that your wild days are gone. You're on your way to honors in Love 101. Do, 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 do.
With them, they're a fun band.
Yeah, man, so great and very unique sound, and you know, and Mark is a great front man, you know what I mean? And Mark is an example of that. You don't have, and he'll tell you that you don't have to have a great voice, you know what I mean? If you have,
right,
if you have attitude,
charisma.
Yeah. And yeah. I remember Chris Blackwell, who was the greatest record man of all time. Lucky enough to call him my friend and my kind of mentor. And Chris told me that the record business has nothing to do with the voice. Mm. When if you mention, like, I won't say any names, but somebody won the Voice, and I said to him, what do you think about that person who won the Voice? And he goes, that person's career is over. And I was like, what are you talking about? They just won The Voice, the biggest show in the world. And he says, the music business has nothing to do with voice. Hmm. It's about image,
right,
attitude, and songs.
Right.
You know? And if you have those three, then you make it. And then that's why he created somebody like Grace Jones.
Yeah.
Of course, and Grace Jones' voice is not that amazing. You know, she's gotten better through the years.
She's like an intriguing story.
She's an incredible artist. Just like, you know, she has that image and that presence and that attitude. And he found the right songs for her with Sly and Robbie and all that. And so basically, Grace Jones is an example of that. You don't have to be able to sing like Mariah Carey or Whitney Houston, you know, or Celine Dion to make it. You can just, if you have the right vibe, like Mark McGrath has that vibe, and on stage, and if you can charm the people and have that vibe, you know, that's what it's all about.
And Chris, he discovered Bob Marley. Yeah.
U2.
Yeah,
man. Steve Winwood.
Yeah.
So many people.
I forgot Steve Winwood was on Island. That's right. Yeah. Iconic music. It's like the fabric of our years, you know what I mean? It's like legendary stuff. All Hall of Famers.
Right. And he always, you know, found stuff that was tasteful. He didn't really do much pop stuff, you know? Even that Sugar Ray song, I mean, it's kind of just very, it's more pop than what I usually do. But right. I said, let me just write a song with three or four chords that can be simple and still have a little bit of credibility, but very, very pop. You know, I was trying to write a song like Prince's Manic Monday.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Prince obviously is not his proudest moment because he has so many amazing songs like Purple Rain and, you know, but Doves Cry. But Prince just said, let me just write a three-chord song and get number one. And he did it with Manic Monday and gave it to the Bangles. And he didn't sing it himself. So sometimes you just want to experiment and try something pop and see if you can do it and see if it comes out good. Because if you do everything dark and deep, like Late September and May, the first song that we played, people might never hear it, you know.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of mix it up and do a little bit of, you know, a little bit of commercial stuff along with deep stuff.
Now, you made the transition from working on tape to digital. What was that transition for you? Were you just going to, like, were you happy about all the conveniences of digital technology versus analog? Because I tend to go backwards now. I go back to tape because I think that's even better to make records than, you know, digital. So
definitely.
How do you feel
about it? I mean, obviously the warmth that tape gives you don't get it on digital. But digital is so much more convenient. And so the whole idea is to lay it down on tape and get that warmth. And then if you transfer it off to digital and for the editing and all that sort of stuff and overdubs, then it's a lot easier, you know. So the digital makes it easy, but if you really want that warm sound, that's why so many studios now are going back to 24-track tape and real tape and all that, so you can actually hear it in the grooves.
Exactly. You hear the warmth. Mm-hmm. You hear the, you know, anything sustained, like I find any saxophone or if it's cello or a voice, anything that, like, you can't capture that on digital ways of, you know, just recording. Mm-hmm. But with tape, it just sounds velvety. It just sounds like it's in the room, you know? So, anyways, who are some of your biggest influences, too? I don't think I've ever asked you that question.
Well, obviously, growing up as a kid and being to be around Bob Marley and getting to jam with him and all that, so that was the biggest thing. And the greatest songwriter of all time, just to be in the room with him was really special. And my band Native, we got to open for him on a show. And
That was
really cool because what happened was that, you know, we had a big backdrop. You know, you have a huge backdrop in the back. And it was Mark Native, which was the name of the band. So we opened for Bob, and then we came off stage, and I said to them, don't take down the banner, right? So Bob came and performed with the Native banner behind him, and 60 Minutes was doing a special on Bob. So they shot Bob with the Native banner behind him.
Awesome.
So we got on 60 Minutes by doing that. So my advice to any bands out there is always have a huge banner and never take it down, you know, because when somebody goes and watches a band, at the end of the night, they say, what was the name of that band again?
Right.
Whereas if there's a huge banner behind them with name blaring at them, then they'll remember it.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. What a story. I mean, I got chills, man.
Yeah.
What songs were you around him when he was recording?
From the second album, because I met him right after Catch a Fire. And that's another thing when my world changed to Technicolor was my cousin Dickie Jobson came to me and he said, you know, we just signed Bob Marley to Island and I want you to hear the record. And he put on Concrete Jungle for me, and that just completely changed my life. That opening with that guitar thing, reggae had never sounded like that before. Before that, reggae was just pop music. And now I knew that, because I'd been following Bob from early days, and I used to tell everybody that the Wailers have the best harmony in the world when you listen to Trenchtone Rock, all the stuff with Lee Perry, Scratch Perry. And so I knew that the Wailers had it, but I never thought that they would go in that rock direction that would take them. So between Chris Blackwell and my cousin, they took them in the rock direction. And when I heard the opening of Concrete Jungle, it just changed my life, and I knew that was it. And so then I went to the studio with them when they were recording Burning, and I was actually in the studio the night when they did Pass It On, which is one of the best songs of all time, Bonnie Wailer's song. Kind of emotion and the lyric in that song is just, you know, it's like Live for yourself, you will live in vain. Live for others, you will live again. In the kingdom of Jah, man shall reign. Pass it on. So the whole idea of passing on everything that you have is just like such a genius.
And that's song. Like a B-side. That's a hard track. That's a B-side. Crazy. It's like,
yeah, how can it be that brilliant
and
be a B-side?
I know. That's what I ask myself all the time.
Unbelievable. And Bonnie Wailer, just being around Bonnie too, and I still see him once in a while. Absolute genius. That his album called Black Heart Man, I tell everybody it's the greatest reggae album of all time.
He did that last year, 2 years ago?
No, this was the album at the time when Bob Marley put out Natty Dread. Peter Tosh did Legalize It, and Bonnie Wailer did Black Heart Man.
Oh, I don't know that record.
Oh my gosh, it's early, way, way back. It's early, and even Bonnie and I said to him, Bonnie, you realize that the greatest reggae album of all time is Black Heart Man? And he said, I have to admit, even Bonnie Wailer has never done anything close to that again.
Wow.
And he said the reason why those three albums were so great was because he said both Natty Dread, Legalize It, and Black Heart Man were all the three Wailers worked on each other's records. So he said they were really just Wailers records. They were just putting it out under my name, but the other two guys were on it, and each of us shared the whole thing, to make it. So it was really Wailers records, and that's why they were so great.
Man, Wayne, where can people find you if they want you to produce them?
Let me see. I'm on Facebook and also Instagram.
What's your handle so people know?
Yeah, Wayne. It's Wayne Jobson at both places. Wayne Jobson.
So it's WayneJobson.
Yeah.
I got to spell it out because people are dumb.
Right. And Native Wayne, if you Google Native Wayne as well, but Wayne Jobson. And then the other thing I have coming up, we have a TV show we're just putting together, which is kind of based on the Soul Train, but it's called International Reggae Train. And we've been shooting it in New York. We just shot the pilot with Shaggy performing.
That's awesome.
And we have, we have the dancers. So it's basically reggae music, and you have the dance and the food and the fashion and the whole thing. And we're recreating Soul Train, but with reggae and having all the great artists in it and all that. So it's going to be, I've done radio long enough. Now I think it's time that, because TV is so powerful, that if we can take reggae, if we can get reggae to the masses through TV, then that'll be the key,
That's awesome. Wayne, we're going to have you back. Fantastic. You've been a wonderful guest. I could do a 10-hour interview with you. I mean, your story is so interesting, man. And you got the best stories.
Yeah.
I had this date like pinned on my, on my calendar for a couple of weeks, and I'm like, man, I can't wait for that interview because I know he's got the coolest stories ever. We're going to have you back.
Wicked, man.
But, man, thank you for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood.
Thanks for having me, man. And people should know, I hope you've been playing your own band, because your band is really wicked.
Of course. Definitely. I mean, we're going to have to do a song together now.
Definitely,
man.
Let's do some stuff.
Well, Wayne, thank you so much for swinging by, and we really appreciate it. Ronan, thank you for filling in for Eddie.
My pleasure.
My co-host with the most, man. We'll see you guys next week.
Maximum respect.